This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In her work helping to rebuild Afghanistan, Sarah Chase dresses as a man, has faced down a former warlord, and directed the reconstruction of a village. Perhaps you recognize her name. Sarah Chase is a former NPR correspondent who covered Paris, Kosovo, and the fall of the Taliban. Now she's field director of the Kandahar branch of Afghans for Civil Society, which was founded by an uncle of Afghanistan's interim prime minister, Hamid Karzai. The group's mission is to promote democracy in Afghanistan by contributing to the formulation of public policy and the physical rebuilding of the country. Sarah Chase's first major project was directing the reconstruction of a Kokalacha, a small village near the Kandahar airport. Half of the houses in the village were decimated during the Allied bombing of the airport in one of the last big battles before the fall of the Taliban. The goal was to rebuild the 30 mud brick huts that were destroyed and to add something they previously lacked, stone foundations. This required getting stones and getting access to the quarry, and that wasn't easy.
It was a wild story. One day our chief engineer comes in to me and says, there's a problem with the stone. And the problem with the stone turned out to be that the governor's men in arms had blocked our tractor at the quarry and weren't permitting us to get any stone for foundations. Now, the landscape there is extremely forbidding, and about the only thing that there is in plenty is stone, right? But it turns out what we learned as we followed this labyrinth through to its source was that the governor was imposing a monopoly on stone in favor of his brother-in-law and another partner. And so nobody in the entire city was able to get stone, legally anyway, in order to conduct reconstruction. I mean, here you were in a province devastated by 30 years of almost uninterrupted violence and destruction, and finally there was a glimmer of an opportunity to begin a reconstruction process, and the very governor of the province was preventing that from happening in order to corner the market, basically.
Okay, so who is this guy, this governor, who is preventing his own people from rebuilding their homes?
This guy is called Gulagha Shirzai, which means something like noble flower Shirzai. He was governor of Kandahar province before the Taliban, and indeed it's partly because of his governing style that the people of southern Afghanistan actually kind of welcomed the Taliban, because so much murder and mayhem and arbitrary violence and looting took place on his watch that the people were desperate for anything that could impose a semblance of order. And what happened was, as the United States was launching or involved in the conflict, Hamid Karzai, who's now president of the country, was negotiating his way down toward Kandahar. Kandahar had been the stronghold and the real capital of the Taliban regime. And there was felt on the part of the Pentagon, presumably, a need for a military action to put pressure on this negotiating situation. So Gulagha was kind of chosen as a guy who had guns and who could muster people with guns, and inserted with U.S. assistance onto the road to the south of Kandahar. And then what happened was this was a major battle at the airport, which is just south of Kandahar, which was the last stand of Al-Qaeda. And Gulagha was involved in that battle. Karzai obtained the surrender of the Taliban and asked Gulagha to remain outside the city. He did not want him to become governor. And what happened was Gulagha invaded the city in order to regain his position as governor. And Karzai, who is extremely conflict-averse, was not willing to have another bloodbath, more Afghans dying, and basically gave in to the blackmail.
And what about the United States? Gulagha had helped the United States take the airport in Kandahar. So did the United States help Gulagha become governor or stay governor?
Yeah, in the sense that the arms that made it possible for him to invade Kandahar had been provided to him by the United States. They continued to provide him with arms after he was inside the city. So they continued to arm him, in a sense, against their other anti-Taliban allies who were grouped around Karzai. It was a very odd situation. And, you know, to the point, I actually drove into Kandahar with one of Gulaga's soldiers, and I was asking him about this. And I asked him the exact same question after he described, you know, how they swooped down the hill toward the city with all guns blazing and sticking out of their pickup trucks and all this kind of thing. I said, where were the Americans? And he said, oh, the Americans told us to do it. And I was just quite amazed that, in a sense, we were instrumental in pitting two different anti-Taliban groups against each other. What then started to happen is that relationships that are created in battle, in the field, have a kind of longevity, so that as American forces finished their rotation and new ones came in, you know, there was a kind of fraternization, I think, that was going on with Gulaga's people. And so that relationship was really cemented, so that, for example, Gulaga's brother is the one who provides security to, you know, outer ring security to the U.S. base at the airport south of Kandahar. That also then means that most reconstruction contracts, the bidding conferences, are actually held in the compound belonging to the brother of Gulaga. And in these sorts of almost accidental ways, this relationship gets cemented, and Gulaga is able to use this kind of support or backing of the United States to further entrench his own position. And I don't think this was a deliberate policy at all. I think it just kind of evolved out of an alliance of convenience.
And favors that are owed back and forth.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Well, so you've hit on what is maybe a kind of typical problem of nation building after war, which is that some of the alliances that forge during the actual fighting are not the best alliances when it comes to building democracy after the war is over.
You said it. I think that's a really, really major issue that we all need to think about, particularly as, you know, our attention turns to Iraq, which in many ways is a similar situation. And I think that what happens is, because of these post-war situations, almost de facto, the most important U.S. presence on the ground ends up being the military. And that means that everything the military does in its own mission has political ramifications on the ground. But nobody really told the guys on the ground that they were making policy. And so they don't necessarily take in the right information. They don't make their decisions in a kind of political consciousness, if that makes any sense. And what I've actually found with the military is that they, at least, you know, those officers that I've had a chance to speak with, is that they are actually quite open to criticizing themselves and to adjusting their behavior once they realize that their behavior can have such incredibly important political ramifications on the ground.
Well, let's get back to the saga of getting the stones that you needed to build the stone foundations for the village that you were trying to rebuild in Kandahar. You know, you couldn't get the stones because the governor, who's very corrupt, wanted you to just do business with his family's cement company and to not get the stones from the mountains. So how did you get what you needed, finally?
Brute force, basically, meaning we argued with him then and kind of cajoled him into setting up a meeting with the local director of mines and industry. And we dragged him out to the quarry and kind of showed him that this was the only place that we could actually get stones, and got him to kind of give us a special dispensation. And that, after, you know, again, some effort, ended up working. Unfortunately, what then happened was, as soon as we got all the stone we needed, the quarry operator was jailed for about 10 days. And then we had to also raise a lot of cane to get him out of jail.
You must have felt awful knowing that he was put in prison because you convinced him to give you the stones you needed.
Terrible. We felt really terrible. And it was like one of these situations where individuals suffer in a kind of effort to change a bigger picture. We did get him out and he wasn't mistreated. We were really scared because there's some very bad stories about what happens in the governor's jails, too. And we were growing white hair and were really relieved that he wasn't mistreated in any kind of way. On the other hand, what did happen is he had stockpiled a lot of broken pieces of stone that are good for turning into gravel. And all of that material was bulldozed over to the governor's family's cement factory so that they could use it for gravel and cement. So it was also a kind of major theft, the jailing.
Do you think that the problems you've had in just trying to get stone to rebuild the foundations in the village that you're trying to rebuild in Kandahar, do you think these are typical problems in Afghanistan now, trying to rebuild in the aftermath of the war and trying to build a democracy? Or is this just some kind of unusual story that you happen to run into?
I can't speak very well for areas other than the South, but I do know that there is a Gulaga in, you know, at least five major provinces in the country. And this is how warlords work, is that they use every resource at their disposal to further consolidate their own personal power and their own control over these resources. And that's where I think, being close to the ground in the way that we are allows us to try to provide aid in a conscious way, provide assistance, I don't want to say aid, in a conscious way so that rather than reinforcing a detrimental situation, we're actually trying to empower the Afghan people. And I think that takes being very close to the ground. It takes not hiding behind the kind of fig leaf of being apolitical. I mean, in a way, you can't be apolitical, even in the reconstruction business, because you can actually reinforce something that is against the interests of the Afghan people. So I actually think that this story of ours with our little village is very emblematic of exactly what's the biggest problem in the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And indeed, I suspect in Iraq there's going to be a similar version because warlordism is, it's like a new ideology in a way.
Sarah, so how far have you gotten in actually rebuilding the village in Kandahar that you've been trying to rebuild, the village that was decimated by U.S. bombing?
We actually finished building that village. It's done. It was a saga because there was not only the tussle with the governor, but there was also a certain degree of tussle with the villagers who saw us as dollar signs in a way coming out of the sky and who were dealing with us. You know, this is also a country that has had no future for the last 30 years. And so people have a hard time thinking in terms of developing a relationship which will be an ongoing relationship and which will bring them a variety of different kinds of support over time. And they were basically negotiating like there's no tomorrow. They were determined to get the biggest, nicest houses they could possibly get from us. And it was a frustrating, I mean, our original intention was to rebuild the houses exactly as they had been. But we discovered that we couldn't actually find out how they had been because we kept being told that they were 9 rooms big with a bathroom in every room and air conditioners and stuff like that. And so we ended up, you know, building pretty standard houses. And they were, to some extent, disappointed because they were hoping to get their mansions. But we did have a lovely sort of epilogue when we were scouring the region for another village to rebuild and stopped a farmer in his field and asked, you know, whether he knew whether American bombs had destroyed anything in that area. And it was not far from Akokalacha, which is the one that we did rebuild. And he said, oh, yeah, there was one right next to the airport, you know, but some humanitarian organization rebuilt it, and now it's a good Kalacha. And so that was nice.
Sarah, you are working in a culture where women do not have equal rights, and under the Taliban particularly, they weren't even allowed out in public unless they were totally covered from head to foot, and even then they weren't, they were only allowed out in public under certain circumstances. You basically dress like a man in your travels through Kandahar. Why don't you describe the clothing that you wear?
It's a very loose sort of knee-length shirt called a kameez, and then enormously loose trousers. When I first saw that are held tight at your hips by often a very beautiful sparkly beaded belt, and when I first ordered my first pair of these, I actually thought they had gotten the measurements wrong. I had thought they had exchanged the length and the width, because honestly, when you hold the thing out, it's basically your two arms outstretched. It's very well adapted to the weather, which is extremely hot in the summertime. Then there's just a piece of cloth that's got this incredible Kandahari embroidery worked across both ends that you can either sort of throw over your shoulders as a shawl, throw over your head to cover your hair if you happen to be female like me, or actually even tie around your head as a turban. And when it started getting really, really, really insufferably hot, that's what I started to do, because I just couldn't bear having an extra layer on me. And I actually decided to wear these clothes back when I was reporting, when I went, and it was during the conflict, and I went up from Quetta, where I was based, to Chaman, which is right on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it's an extremely conservative small town. Indeed, it's where a lot of the Taliban came from. It's where a lot of them got their madrasa education. And I noticed that there were zero women on the street. There were absolutely none, and there were no Westerners. And I kind of thought, look, I've got four choices. I can either wear a burqa, which I'm not going to do. I can wear Western clothes, which would be like wearing neon lights. I could wear Pakistani women's clothes, which is what I would wear down in Quetta, but that's like wearing neon lights because there are no women in the street. Or I could wear men's clothes, which, and it's not like I was trying to disguise myself as a man.
It's not Yentl.
Yeah, exactly. But what it was trying to create a kind of optical illusion so that at least from a distance of 50 yards, I wouldn't be gathering a crowd, because that's what would happen otherwise. And it actually worked. And so I continued to wear them in Kandahar when the Taliban finally fell and I went in. And now I could wear Western clothes because there are enough Westerners in Kandahar, but I've just gotten used to it, and it's kind of become my. I mean, I think I'm a bit of a circus freak show there anyway, and so it kind of goes with the territory.
Okay, so you're wearing a turban, you're wearing men's clothes. Do you confuse some of the men who you have to deal with? Not only the men you're working with, the men you're working with in Afghans for Civil Society understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, but you're also dealing with this corrupt governor, and you're dealing with a lot of people. You're dealing with villagers who don't know who you are or what you're doing there until you've had a chance to explain it to them. So do some of them think that you're bizarre, being a woman dressing like a man? Gender bending is not... It's right. Not common in Afghanistan,
right? Drag is not common yet. I think I do confuse people, and now, as I say that there are more Westerners and Western women working in Kandahar, I really do stick out. What I hear in the street all the time is people saying "Shazada, Shazada." It's a woman. That's a woman, And now I've taken, I kind of take it in stride and. Kind of wink and say, oh, that's a little boy. That you're a boy. You're a boy. And so I kind of hand it back to them, and people laugh and all that. Occasionally people do ask me, why do you wear men's clothes? And I pull out this old saga. Or sometimes I'll say, well, you know what? In America, I wear men's clothes too. So why shouldn't I do it here? And it's just, I do think there's a kind of license that's allowed to foreigners, mm-hmm. Even in very conservative Muslim countries. I've lived in a couple. And as a kind of professional woman, which breaks all the rules anyway, you're sort of treated like a Martian. You're some other object that's allowed to gender bend in a way. And I found this. I lived in Morocco a long time ago, and I would find men would take my hand, which is a completely unthinkable gesture between a man and a woman in a country like Morocco or Afghanistan, but they were reacting to me like to a man, while at the same time I can go and hang out with the women. So it's actually a real privilege to be a foreign woman in this kind of a country.
Just one more question about being a woman working in Afghanistan. Do some of the men in Afghanistan think that because you're an American woman that they can hit on you and that that's okay?
Never happened. Mm-hmm. It's never happened.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Because there again, I think culturally the consequences are so enormous that, that that's really taboo.
What are some of the changes in the lives of women in the villages that you've been working in the post-Taliban society?
The lot of women has improved dramatically since the Taliban were gone. I mean, if nothing else, they can, take a ride in the horse-drawn taxis into town by themselves without having to have a male escort. They can work as teachers. They can go to school as students. But the Kandahar area, anyway, remains an extremely conservative place. And to some extent, a lot of the strictures that the Taliban brought to the rest of Afghanistan were rooted in the most conservative of the local village traditions of the Afghan South. So what we have found is that although you do see women in the street, and although there are a number of programs that, for example, create places where women can work, we have an income generation project which is based on this very fine embroidery that is characteristic of the Kandahar area. And what we have done is decide to go from house to house. It's like the old putting out system before the Industrial Revolution. We bring raw materials to women in about a dozen houses scattered through and around Kandahar, and each house is a focal point for between, I would say, 5 and 30 women. So we're actually employing 200 women throughout the town. And we've been, just amazed at how strong the constraints remain on women in the Kandahar area. And by we, in particular, I mean myself, who has lived in a number of other Muslim countries, and our director of women's programs there, who is an Afghan American, who was born in Afghanistan, and even she has been completely shocked to find how stringent the restrictions remain on women. And so what we're trying to do, this is a very popular program because we're not breaking the rules and because we're not asking, we're not fomenting revolution quite yet, So what we hope to do is to be able to piggyback other activities on this income generation project. One of them that we've already started is simply a neighborhood discussion group. And even that, in one of our neighborhoods where we first proposed to do this, we asked some of our women, well, what if we held a tea once a month and just had a social event for all the women in the neighborhood? And they kind of looked at each other nervously and said, nope, we wouldn't have permission to do it. We can only see other women for weddings and funerals. This turned out to be the home of one of our drivers, and we turned to him, Ali Ahmad, is this true? And he said, look, I know my wife's father and I know her brother, but I don't know her uncle, and so I won't let her go to her uncle's house. Why should I let her go to some stranger's house for a tea? We have found neighborhoods where we could do this that were slightly less conservative, and it's just been an extraordinary, again, we're kind of feeling our way, but it's been an extraordinary experience to bring 30 women together and start talking about the issues that really determine their lives.
Is there still a lot of violence in Afghanistan now? You read in the newspapers about continued attacks from Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters. Do you feel that violence in Kandahar?
We feel in Kandahar a distinct uptick in extremist activity since about January. I mean, it really is noticeable, both in terms of threats. For example, the old technique of leaving what are called night letters in mosques has started again. These are letters that are threatening to people who work with the Americans or work with the new government, threatening to people who send girls to school. One of our families of women who work in our Income Generation Project took their girls out of school because of some of these letters. There are almost, I would say certainly weekly, if not more often, events like, you know, a rocket shot off somewhere to somewhere, you know, usually random. There was an extremely gruesome assassination of an International Red Cross worker just north of Kandahar in a really classic extremist kind of setup where about 30 former Taliban ambushed, you know, blocked off a road, pulled aside the first foreign car they found, radioed for instructions, and killed the one foreigner in the cars. That said, I think it's not like working in Sarajevo during a war or something like that. It's not. I think the reaction on the part of the international humanitarian community has been a little bit excessive. A number have reduced their staffs in the Kandahar area. Some have closed entirely, and I actually don't think that's warranted.
Mm-hmm. Did the war in Iraq penetrate the consciousness of the villagers that you're working with in Afghanistan?
Not really. Not as much as one would have thought from, you know, a U.S. perspective. It turns out that people in post-conflict societies are really self-absorbed. I mean, they're really concerned about getting their own lives going again. They also have long memories in Afghanistan, and they do remember that when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein applauded. And so that reduced the amount of sympathy that there might have been for the Iraqis. I think it's also a really telling point that, you know, here is Afghanistan is an extremely conservative Muslim country that was not opposed to the U.S. Invasion of Iraq. And the real concern that I felt on the ground was that the U.S. attention would turn so quickly away from Afghanistan just at a moment when U.S. people on the ground were starting to get enough of an understanding to really begin to do a good job there. I mean, it really took a year and a half for Americans to become familiar enough with Afghanistan and with the conditions there for their activities and actions and assistance and intervention to make a positive difference. And so Afghans were really worried, oh my God, they're going to leave us, and then where will we be?
Well, has that happened? Do you feel that a lot of American attention has been diverted from Afghanistan to Iraq?
I think that's really happened. You can feel it in Washington. In other words, when we have to approach USAID in Washington, we find that all of the people we had been working with have been moved over to Iraq. It's very visible in terms of the quantity of assistance that's reaching Afghanistan. I mean, you know, there's just money that was supposed to be earmarked for Afghanistan has been set aside and is now probably on its way to Iraq. On the ground, you don't feel it as much because people who are stationed in Afghanistan are preoccupied with Afghanistan. And so there you do still feel the attention on the ground.
You left journalism. You left your position as an NPR reporter to do this aid and democracy building work in Afghanistan. Why did you leave journalism?
I had felt all the time that I was working in journalism, this issue of how much good are you doing, you know, and especially reporting from Paris, I remember thinking sometimes, golly, my job is to entertain, you know, intelligent and well-to-do Americans with the foibles of intelligent and well-to-do Europeans, you know. I mean, on down days, sometimes I would think that, and kind of would keep myself going by saying, well, just being a foreign correspondent is a kind of sedition, I think, in America. Just keeping other countries on the map in America is a really valuable thing to do. But there was always this kind of desire to participate in some way or to, you know, kind of do something rather than only observing. But nothing quite felt right, because the thought of kind of joining the international humanitarian industry, which it is sort of, didn't quite feel right. And what happened in this case was just, it was just a fluke. I mean, it fell into my lap, and it was so perfect. It was so right. I was leaving the area. I had had a pretty long rotation, about 2.5 months, and I was saying goodbye to sort of favorite people and good sources and things like that. And one of them was the uncle of the Karzais, whom I had interviewed a couple of times only, but they had each time been really, really insightful interviews. I mean, he really was able to give me a kind of grasp of what the situation meant that I hadn't gotten elsewhere. And I really like him. He's intelligent. He's very insightful, but never too negative, you know. And as I, you know, we had dinner, and as I left, he just looked at me and said, "Wouldn't you come back and help us?" And it was like, it was sort of the clarion call. And I think the other factor really is these Karzais, whom more than any other political figure that I've encountered in any other post-conflict society or even in America, they move me because I really feel like they are doing everything they can for the good of their people. And it's not a personal agenda. And I just haven't seen that anywhere else. And it felt like, you know, if you've been offered the opportunity to take part in this struggle this way with these people, you just can't turn it down.
Well, Sarah Chase, thank you so much for telling us a bit about the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Sarah Chase is the field director of the Kandahar branch of Afghans for Civil Society. She's a former NPR reporter. A new documentary about her called Life After War has been showing on the film festival circuit.